Andu aitu ni moe tena dhula kuingio ni luwa thome orea gwekaguo.
Acha.
Ni moe.
Tatuere.
Tuhetu era gwa tutahe muhu nangeo. Tuthiororo kiria nyomba na dhula kuitinge kila muhu. Leu tondu ni munake igwa mundu uyu uri na haha rugoro uri areto tora ri. Ngione iharirio wega biu na muhu ni oitwo mihakaini.
For Kenya, art has always been one of our greatest tools to address societal issues. Whether it's through books, artworks, film, music, or even mode of dressing. The way we express our dissatisfaction or enlighten the public has always had an element of performance to it. No, we are not talking about the current fad of performative whatever activity you insert after this that has become the new word after toxic. I mean performance that is built around art. We can simply look at the wristband we all wear or even the amount of Kenyan flag-bearing t-shirts worn during our last protest. Then we have the music, the chants that are made up on the spot, and those that only need us to drop one name for them to make sense. Beyond the chants and the dressing, recording artists have also made a mark in history when it comes to protest music. Since the early days of the Kenyan music scene, they have ensured that their audiences stay informed on current affairs through songs. For the artist, this comes with risks such as arrests, imprisonment, industry blackballing, loss of funds, and, you know, a lot more. So in this episode, I look at how history has treated those who decided to confront the powers of the time and how it affected their careers, their creativity, and the country as a whole. Think of this episode as an exploration into the history of protest music in Kenya, its evolution, and the impact it has had.
Dope days, chill nights, good company, and mellow vibes. You're listening to Out the Booth Podcast, a Kenyan podcast exploring, playing, and uncovering the finest music in Kenya, at the same time highlighting ongoing matters within the entertainment industry, as well as playing select picks from artists across Africa.
When you think of protest music, what comes to mind? Is it the socially aware artist, or is it the direct artist who name drops a politician, leader, or power that is undermining the people? As a Kenyan, do you know the stories behind some of the songs of protest or the reasons regarding why some songs have been banned by your government over the years? It was not always due to nudity, promoting drug use, or going against culture. Some songs and musicians were in the business of speaking truth to power. Their intention was to create public awareness or to warn those in power. But don't just take my word for it. Let's go into the details and the stories behind said songs. We'll start from post-independence, a time when governance was finally given to the people of Kenya, when musicians could finally get a chance to express themselves fully without the colonial powers controlling their creative expression. Prior to independence, local language songs had been very limited due to some being encoded language that was alleged to have aided in the fight against colonialists. However, this limitation would not last long, as we are proud of our culture and language is a huge contributor to that culture. That is why after independence, some artists became more prominent within their communities for their clever use of language and very insightful and impactful music. At the same time, education had finally become accessible and available, and people finally saw the power that came with being informed and creating a society of informed people. The creative individuals who came up at this time knew this. They wanted their people to be aware about what was happening around the country and how change was with them and how it could only be driven further by them. They also realized how much propaganda was being driven by this new breed of leaders. The fake promises, the lavish lifestyles while their people suffered, and most of all, how they had acquired this so-called wealth. So the question arose, how do we keep the public aware of the power that they themselves have? If you ask me, this is what led to songs by artists such as Joseph Kamaru, Ishmael Nganga, Osumba Rateng, and more. These musicians could not help but address pressing matters from the effect of governance. they would occasionally create a song so impactful that it would cause the leaders themselves to react. Kenyan musicians and creatives felt the need to also educate the public on matters of governance and the future of the nation. This led to one of the first instances of music critique to the government when poet and writer Abdi Latif Abdallah released his essay, Kenya Twendapi, an essay that questioned the direction the country was being steered toward by the ruling class at the time. His essay led to him being charged with conspiracy, and it also saw him serve 3 years at Shimola Tewa. Leaders who had finally realized their propaganda was being debunked decided to use imprisonment as a way to control public dissent. To them, this would serve as a lesson for those who dared question authority. Yet, it only fueled the fire. The arrest of Abdi Latif may have impacted one creative person's work, but the public was now aware, and there's nothing they feared more than awareness, as they realized it would only lead to more questions. The essay is actually available to read on various websites across the web, and recently I think I came across a clip of him performing it, albeit years later, as he saw the same issues persist. So that begs the question, does your vote actually count if we keep putting the same people who upheld previous ideals into power? Shouldn't results and actual professionals in certain fields be the ones to push us forward? And also, have you taken your voter's card? At the time of Abdi Latif's arrest, activism had mostly been in the written form, from news articles, books, or even whole publications that had previously been questioning colonial powers and even those that came after. As time progressed, recording artists decided to take it to the ears of the people. Instead of just limiting it to those who could read and write, they took it to the roots of spoken word, adding an instrument or two. Among the first artists to take this on was Ishmael Nganga, who released his song Maeni Maruru. Translated, this means bitter waters. Of course, it's a Kikuyu song, so, you know, Maeni Maruru is bitter waters. The song itself referenced a story from the Bible. He addressed how even after gaining our independence and being governed by our own, citizens were still facing neocolonialism. While the promises of a better tomorrow were made, it was clear that only those at the top were the beneficiaries. This, of course, is just one translation. The other one is that it represents a bitter relationship with a partner who promised you sweet nothings, you know? That is according to the comments on the YouTube video. But for the purpose of this episode, we'll stick with the first. After its release, the song was banned, and due to the limitation of having only a single broadcaster, the tactic worked. It is said that the government even went further to condemn the message in the song. To paraphrase, they said, "The fruits of an independent nation should not be compared to the bitter waters the Israelites encountered during the Exodus." Religion became a defense for personal vendettas. I wonder if that reminds you of anyone, my dear Kenyan listener. In the late 60s, Kenya faced a series of politically driven assassinations. Political rivalry had gone beyond tribe or religion. It became a matter of ideals. Suddenly, those in power felt challenged by younger, vibrant, and more informed players who joined the field. One such assassination was that of J.M. Kariuki. It was one of the most gruesome murders, as his mutilated body was found disposed in a forest far from his intended destination or last seen location. What followed was public outrage, as he had been a huge campaigner for proper governance and had been a huge critic of the Kenyatta government at the time. His slogan was, "We don't want a country of 10 millionaires and 10 million beggars." His assassination would then lead to an era of repression for government critiques. Soon after his death, Benga artist Joseph Kamaru took to the studio to pen a song dedicated to his remembrance. Kamaru had been a personal friend of JM, as well as Kenyatta, but the incident drove a rift between him and the then president. The song was aptly titled JM Karaoke, and it was one of the few that received quite the attention, selling over 75,000 physical copies. Yes, selling 75,000 physical copies. However, and once again, the government intervened and banned it from receiving airplay on the state broadcaster, VOK. The thing about this and most songs that do get banned, especially for political reasons, is that the message is undeniably uniting. In JM Karaoke, Kamaru urges the people not to take action for his death. He pleads for a bleeding nation that at the time eliminated its finest minds in the most brutal fashion. He questions the motives of those who committed the heinous act, as it only showed how little value they held for the future of the nation. At the same time, he warns those who had committed the act of the punishment that awaits them, or should I say, of the karma that awaits them. He urges other critiques to proceed with caution, lest they suffer a similar or worse fate. Following the ban of Kamaru's song and the imprisonment of Abdi Latif, you would think that the matter of addressing politics through music would die down. Quite the opposite. The whole essence of being a creative is the intensity of your empathy. You cannot help but feel the plight of others along with that of your own. This is often not easy to explain in plain words, hence we create. Regime change from Kenyatta to Moi only came with more additional tactics to curb the power of music. Kamaru, who at this time had gained quite the popularity, would then form an alliance with the new president that saw him accompany him on his trip to Japan. Once he was back in the country, he changed his tune and sang multiple songs in praise of Moi, which kept him in the president's good graces. There were so many praises, you know, so many songs that were just praising him, that he created the album Safari ya Japani, where he elucidated on all the great things we could expect from Moi. And while this kept him safe from state bans, it lost him a huge number of his core audience. See, they realized he had been bought out, and this was quite clear to his listeners. They knew him as a staunch critic of questionable characters, whether in his home, in the community, and even for those in power. Now that he was pandering to the government, the people lost faith in him, but that wouldn't last long. A unique tactic that was employed by the Moi regime was the use of choirs. Remember the time when choirs were the most popular musicians within the country? This is where that practice may have originated. He would employ songwriters and music groups, especially those religiously inclined, to sing him praises and also to drown out dissenting voices. This period saw the release of songs such as Tawala Kenya, Tushangilie Kenya, Amka Kumepambazuka, which I think I had way too many times, Kipenzi Moi, and many more. All these songs had one recurring theme, and that was presenting Moi as the most necessary and effective leader the country would have. Nyayo era music was solely based on this. This information I actually got from a Substack article by Joyce Nyairo. It's called Moi's Music. I'll attach the links in case you're curious. But like an idea that still hasn't been pursued, banned music permeated, and there were still musicians who had something to say. And since poetic literary devices were in use, why not employ some of that in their music? In 1988, Joseph Kamaru released the album Mahoya Mafururi. To translate it from Kikuyu, that means prayers of the nation. Taking on a religious undertone, a practice that Kamaru is famous for, he wished well for the president, with whom he had fallen out of favor with at this point. According to records of history, and should I also say allegedly, Kamaru had been against the centralization and personalization of power under Moi since it was laying a foundation for a dictatorship. Around the same time, upon being invited to the 1992 Madaraka Day celebrations, Kamaru warned him not to be comfortable, or to paraphrase, don't sit comfortable with your rungu. The songs in the album Mahoya Mafururi addressed the regime. It's alleged that the release led him to receiving an offer of approximately 800,000 Kenyan shillings to translate one of the songs to Swahili, of which he did. However, upon, you know, going to deliver the song, he received nothing for it, and of course, the Swahili version got much less attention. One of the groups that employed literary devices was the Sega Sega band led by Daniel Owino Misiani and Peter Owisi. They released Baba Otonglo, a song that uses humor to share a much deeper message.
Vyakula vimepanda, ukame umezidi, vitu vyote vimepanda, Baba Otonglo, Baba Otonglo.
The song addressed the issue of budgeting and its distribution by incorporating the imagery of a wealthy businessman and his large polygamous family. Apparently, they had to take certain cuts as money had now become scarce and spread too thin. The family leader spoke on how breakfast would have to be black tea or porridge, while meals such as beef and chicken would be eaten maybe once or twice a month. Its chorus was Vodka Unisamehe, Budget Iko Hai. On the surface, the song comes across as a creative way to express what many families go through when the breadwinner is facing financial trouble. However, this is not how the leaders interpreted it. To them, the artist was attacking them directly, as they were the ones controlling the country's budget. They saw it as a critique on their handling of affairs, since, as always, they claim to know best and are the ones who can tell people what is actually happening and how it's supposed to be. The government would proceed to ban this song, which, to their demerit, only worked as a way to make it more popular. Later on, it's reported that police were sent to his home in Babadogo, where they arrested him for criticizing the government and incitement. He was later released after explaining that the song was simply creative expression. It's also alleged that at some point he was threatened with deportation, considering he had been born in Shirati, Tanzania. As you can see, nothing was off the table for government critiques. As time progressed, Kamaru released a song, Nimaitho Tuunete, which, from Kikuyu, is translated to, We have only averted our eyes. The song was more of a warning to the political class that, inasmuch as the public may seem silent, they are very well aware of the ongoings at the time. The song was widely appreciated by the general public, not so much by those who inspired its writing. Up until this point, most musicians who have been featured have either used local dialects and Kiswahili to create public awareness on government propaganda. In response to this, the authorities decided to buy them out, arrest them, imprison them, and even threaten a few with deportation. Of course, these are only from the reported stories. We have no idea what other tactics had been employed. Other than the use of choirs to try and shut down dissenting voices and controlling airplay for said music, all other methods involved some kind of force.
Your feedback means a lot to the show. That means you can improve your listening experience by easily reaching out. On social media, find the DMs at otbpodke, or you can send an email to otbpodke@gmail.com. Let me know how you like your podcasts.
At the turn of the century, new tactics had to be employed, and with the change of leadership from Moi's 24-year rule came the emergence and adoption of new voices and languages when it came to protest music. By the time Mwai Kibaki was coming into power, Kenyans had opened their eyes into the importance of proper governance and leadership. It became clear to them that for change to happen, they were not only tied to accepting what leadership says, and instead they understood that they were individually and collectively involved in ensuring that their leaders were competent and accountable for the improvement of society. It was also at the same time that educated musicians and producers came together and adapted the Shen language. Until now, the music that had enjoyed popularity and audience appreciation had either been in English, Swahili, and most of all, local dialects. The appreciation for local languages made it relatable, and Swahili made it palatable. In the late 90s and early 2000s, hip-hop and rap music began permeating society. At the time, it was regarded as music for the urban audience, and it did not appeal to the wider Kenyan public. Hip-hop at the time was mostly in English, which was not as prevalent, and the issues being sung about in the songs were not based on Kenya or its people. As we are aware, Sheng at its core is a mix of English and Swahili and any other Kenyan language. The language emerged from youths who grew up in marginalized settlements around the city. So if you combine this idea and the fact that hip-hop has always been a form of protest, you get the emergence of rap groups to air out actual issues experienced by the marginalized, a way to open the public's eyes to life in the ghetto. This is what led to the adoption of Sheng, and especially in addressing societal issues, which would lead to it being embraced as the years progressed. This is when Tafsiri Hii by Kala Mashaka was released.
Straight from the Mau Mau camp, yeah. In the red corner, uh-huh. Muliro, the Oteroa, yeah. In the blue corner, Kamau, Chekikidia, I'm the referee, the mister, the Yeti, Doka Kala Mashaka,
The song itself addressed living conditions in Dandora, the lack of opportunities, police brutality, and the political factors that led to this situation. They were among the pioneers of using Sheng for political music. Kala Mashaka would evolve, and in collaboration with Ukoflani, they created the supergroup Mau Mau, a powerful name in Kenyan history, as the organization is credited for being at the forefront in the fight for Kenya's independence. A fight that they were now embarking on, only this time, it wasn't against foreign powers, but in challenging the status quo. The urban youth movement was using their talents to speak truth to power, and it was having an impact as they now could include themselves in working towards the future that they had been promised. With the emergence of a new form of Kenyan music, challenges are never far behind. This time around, it came from the limitation in broadcast media and performance opportunities. At the time, the larger number of audiences were found among ethnically based musicians, and this is where the commercial differences were seen, a situation that remains familiar even to date. Instead of using force and imprisonment or government itself to limit the artists who were criticizing the government and creating awareness, it became easier to use media channels as a means to censor them. With the already existent ones being controlled by the government, it was easy to limit Sheng music. The language itself would feature in ads, but the music was the problem. The use of Sheng, apparently, in music became a point of contention, especially with the empowered public and affiliated radio stations, as they believe English, local languages, and maybe gospel is the only music that would be worth of their airplay. Mau Mau Music Group and other musicians who embraced Sheng were now faced with censorship or simply ignorance. The underlying cause was that social awareness through Sheng was not acceptable. There was also the implication that their music was too ghetto-focused and it did not have the commercial appeal in comparison to what was safe. The audience excuse was used to limit them, while at the same time, the audiences had no idea of said music. For a while, the tactic worked. No airplay meant they became lesser known, but it only fueled their tenacity, as you could hear it in the music. Songs such as Angalia Saa by Kitu Siwa, Dandora Love by Zaka Ka and Kabi, as well as System Ya Majambazi by Mashifta, became staples in Kenyan hip-hop culture. I'm probably going to mention a personal favorite, which is Pesa Pombe Siasa na Wanawake by Kitu Siwa and Jiwiji from Mashifta. As mentioned, censorship was not based on the language alone, rather due to the issues addressed in the songs. They spoke to the youth and the independent shows were most appreciated. It did take years for this acknowledgement, but due to the music business shifts, monetary returns from their efforts were less prevalent. At the same time, you had artists such as Eric Wainaina and Kayamba Africa, whose music was considered safe. This is because it could be easily passed as happy-go-lucky songs that would be appreciated by tourists in the international community. This safe mentality was carried on for years, and the group Mau Mau would eventually dissolve as their lives took on different paths. One thing that stayed was the impact that their music had.
Akimechoka, ni aje nchi kuna GDP ya 80 million na si tumesota. Vile vitu zinakaa itabidi nipange ni hamiocha. Sitai kuwa na boss, ata sipenangi watu wa dosi. Plot imejezo na garika saba ni kama moja haitoshi. Just being honest man, nibaga 5, if I couldn't go toka. Just being honest, you don't know the vibes, ego yako ina kuchocha. Just being honest, I'm probably high na hizi mastima zitoki. I know if money was vibes, nyo same ngekuwa mesota. Kauja unga, kauja bonda, budo utatokwa. Ato utolewe ghetto, ghetto haitawa itoka. Kama si Buddha, kasi my ex, minge omoka. Miende ni anzisha beef, mimuwe ni hameocha. Deli kuanga marauna, obuna, omaru kipangia adosi. Siku ingine nukupata na danje, baru kipangia hustle. Tulikuwa tunapima na ufala na watu wengine na yao haitoshi. R.I.P. Chichi, wanna make your family never gonna worry. Unajua Miss Church. Adama karawaki kujua tufukuzi, unajua Miss Church.
One of the major reasons I decided to cover this particular topic was majorly due to the current environment and nationwide interest in governance. An interest that has majorly come from the informed youth, discontent with recycled leaders, and the previous generations being complacent despite years of promises from said leaders. In June 2024, Kenyans from all generations came together to reject the proposed finance bill. This unity could be seen online in the newspapers, and it was culminated by protests that rocked the nation. During this period, a lot of our celebrities were under scrutiny. We kept a close eye on them, as their political leanings and affiliations became an indicator of how and who would support them, and most of all, if they actually cared about their audiences. Musicians were hard hit. We have a history with musicians switching loyalty as soon as they got the opportunity to perform on a national platform. This brought about a different era of protest, creativity, and the art scene did its best to reflect this era. If for the modern day, it's safe to say that governance was not the only key driving factor for protest music. It started way before that. If you remember when the issue of copyright payments began and Calligraph, along with other artists, released multiple tracks berating the authority for undervaluing their work. Later on, King Kaka came up with the track Wajinga Sisi, a poetic performance highlighting the role of citizens in the troubles caused by leaders they themselves elected. Sauti Sol too were not left behind with the song Tujiangalie, which urged Kenyans to actively participate in the betterment of their own livelihoods and leadership. All these songs and the more I've yet to mention are a version of protest music, just like their predecessors who spoke truth to power. By the time we got to 2025, the rotten leadership had become an issue, not just for artists to tell, rather one that citizens themselves were awake to and constantly insisted on the need for others to be aware of. Whether it was TikTok and Instagram videos breaking down bills, independent reporters updating us in the parliamentary sittings, or simply elected officials' activities. Everyone who had a large enough audience and following and had an understanding of governance found it fit to share the little knowledge with the public. For the first time, instead of the audience focus being on the lifestyle of musicians and celebrities, it turned towards their ideologies. What set the tone was not how fancy you looked, what you were dressed in, who you were with. The question that followed them everywhere they went or in any place that they engaged was, what's your stance on your political happening? How do you, as a reflection of our culture, feel about what is happening to your audience? This answer would then inform on how audiences would respond to your future products as an artist or as a musician. You have to wonder if that stood the test of time. Most entertainers understood this. They saw it as a challenge for their growth rather than as an attack on their character. This is why they used their platforms to educate the public. It was an opportunity to set aside their creative projects and show us their academic prowess. They finally had a chance to be seen for being more than a musician, skit maker, or comedian. It was at the same time that we saw a rise in the number of news channels, pages, profiles on different social media platforms. TikTok, which had been a major form of a pastime, became the most up-to-date news source. Of course, this came down to personal algorithm curation. Protest had now taken a new form. Instead of frustrated, singular groups or members of society, it was a collective call for change. In music, we saw those who sided with the government have their numbers and followings dwindle as their names became a footnote in the music scene. For entertainers, they took the chance to collaborate in translating important and crucial information. Most interesting addition to me was the tech community offering their skills for free to ensure information was shared in as many ways and forms as possible across different mediums. They even suggested online platforms where voting could be conducted from, a discussion that I'd like to see continue. All these efforts were the new form of protest in Kenya. The music took different form, but it seems to have shifted. Yet, as the saying goes, the internet never forgets. As the year began, we heard a whole different understanding of the climate within entertainment. Politics had taken a center stage and everyone had an opinion, repeated ones, original ideas, political analysis, and the most lucrative, a controversial one for the numbers. It's still an attention economy, in case you forgot. To wrap this up, as Kenyans, we are a creative and innovative nation. From individuals to organizations, we always find a means to push forward. Recently, there's been a wide call for change in how we are governed, and this is only fueled by changes we are seeing all over the world. Leaders are being deposed, authority is being questioned, and most of all, complacency to accept what has been is shunned. It's only right that our art reflects this. In fact, art has always reflected this, and it is only once the general public comes to accept this that change happens. We are on the cusp of change. So this episode was aimed at providing historical context on how it has been over the years and to remind you that your voice matters. Share the information, educate your neighbor, most of all, question everything that impedes your individuality. Only then can we be the change we want to see.
You've been listening to Out the Booth podcast, a podcast dedicated to portraying the finest music from Kenya and around Africa. I've been your host, Eugene, and you can check out other episodes of the podcast on Spotify or subscribe to the Out the Booth blog on WordPress for more episodes and articles. Till next time, hugs, not drugs. Peace.